Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for December 2017, our special holiday edition of the show, which means absolutely nothing except that we are nestled right now between Christmas and New Year's, and we're feeling the holiday spirit. We've got some eggnog in our glasses and maybe something else mixed in, and Tim's
some
wearing
sweaters.
A Christmas sweater, and we're ready. Happy holidays, Tim.
Hey, happy holidays, John, and Cinema Faith folks. Hopefully you're slacking off at work, listening to our podcast while pretending to work on a spreadsheet or something like that.
That's always the best way to listen to podcasts. That's how I listen to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course. That's everybody, man.
How was your Christmas, Tim?
Good. We're still in Christmas season, theologically. Still,
Merry Christmas. And we're allowed to say Merry Christmas again. That's
you can
so
say
crazy.
It. You're, yeah. We haven't hit Epiphany or whatever.
Christians are experiencing a break from persecution. We can say Merry Christmas. So.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. How?
I don't know what Starbucks feels about this or whatever.
So what'd you do? Did you travel?
Oh, yeah. I do the same thing every year. Just go back to whatever the podcast was. Yeah, I went to Illinois.
I see on Facebook all the time, you have these epic Monopoly battles.
Is oh, you saw this.
Yeah,
about
you
me.
Have a trophy or something. Did you win again this year?
I won this year.
How many games do you play? Can you explain this?
Well, we play every once a year.
Oh, it's just
with
like a
my
big
wife's family.
Game. Okay.
And everyone talks trash and people read books about strategy.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's like kind of twisted.
My Monopoly strategy is just buy every property until I'm broke.
No, there's properties you don't want to buy. But that's like, that's for the Monopoly podcast, which actually may be more popular than this one.
I think it's way more popular than
but
this.
But yeah,
anyway,
definitely.
Fantastic. Well, my Christmas was great. Three kids, you know, three little boys, seeing them open presents, magic. And of course, the New Year's Eve tradition. We talked about this, right? It's a Wonderful Life every year. Been doing it for like
a decade. Is that Capra?
Yeah. Jimmy Stewart. It's not Christmas until everyone gathers around at the end of the movie and sings that song, you know?
Wasn't that film a bomb?
What?
Wasn't that film a bomb initially?
Yeah, bomb. Everyone hated it, thought it was depressing, and then here we go. Now it's a Christmas
classic.
It's
a classic.
It is. Some people hate it. Some people, there's like a backlash. Sometime around this time of year, you'll get that Facebook post that was like, unpopular opinion, but...
My wife hates it.
Yeah, there you go.
She didn't want to watch it. I just like Jimmy Stewart.
I love
Martha.
It. I feel always like blessed to be alive when I watch that movie. Like I'm reminded what matters. So, and of course, as far as holiday season is concerned, we're in Oscar season, right in the smack dab thick of it. I wish my local theater chain would just let me live at the movie theater because I'm there almost every night now, so it would just be easier if I had like a bed or something. There's
Landmark?
Landmark and Marcus, our sponsor for
They're not our sponsor.
Okay, yes, I'm still trying to work on them. I wish they were.
I was there, Marcus. This very the morning of this podcast.
Great. You visited our Marcus location. Fantastic. It's just there's too many good movies. That's the problem. Around this time, I don't understand why they want to save the best 30 movies of the year for 2 weeks.
It's
really frustrating to me.
But... I just came up with an idea just now.
Okay.
I think that you should pay for a movie based on when you see that movie during the day.
Mm.
So, for instance, if you want to go see a movie at 1 in the afternoon, you should pay $1.
Yes, by the hour. Yeah.
But if you're going to be there at like midnight, you should pay $12 to see that movie.
I agree. I like it.
I think it's a terrible idea, but I thought it was a good idea about 5 seconds ago. Everybody's going to go at like 5.
Yeah, right. Then you have everyone going at
and it'll
one
just
time.
Be
that's,
it'll be like stacked with old ladies and kids at like 1.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of good movies out right now, and it's hard. It's hard seeing them all. I've got like a gift certificate to the theater. Someone, best present ever you can give me is like a gift certificate to our local theater chain, and it's not going to cover it. It's just not. There's too many Oscar releases, but it's also amazing. I love it. I love this time of year. And there was some debate last month whether we were going to be reviewing Star Wars or like an Oscar movie, and Tim Nelson won the battle. And we are actually going to be reviewing an Oscar movie, not Star Wars, today. And that's okay with
can
me.
Can I admit something to our audience
please.
Here? All four of them.
Uh-huh. At work.
I've yet to even see Star Wars.
You haven't seen it yet.
No, but it's not because I don't want to see Star Wars.
Yeah.
It's because my wife... I promised to see it with her, and I didn't want to see it beforehand. I know, isn't that nice
of
me?
What a great husband.
Yeah.
That's how it should be. And it's okay. I've seen it. Everyone else in the world has seen it. I'm sorry to inform you of that, Tim. It's made about $800 million.
Three times, four times.
Yeah. All right. I'll just say, no spoilers here, that I liked it better than The Force Awakens. But there were as many things that I liked about it as I hated about it. So I'm just hopelessly split down the middle. I'm sorry to any people out there who want more. Points in this movie where I'm just cheering, like, that is awesome, that's Star Wars. And there were points where I'm just like, blasphemy, that is stands against everything Star Wars is supposed to be about, and I'm stuck. I don't know.
I had this thought about Star Wars, because I haven't seen this movie yet, I'm not excited about this movie. But there's a reason, right? They need to let him breathe a little bit, right?
It's starting to feel a little like Marvel. Just like, take a break.
So even like when they re-released episode 4, 5, and 6 in the, what was that, the late 90s?
Yeah.
There had been like a 10-year break, like 12-year break, right?
Right.
And so like they had breathed a little bit, then they released these remastered ones where George Lucas made some horrible mistakes. And we see things like Han Solo stepping on Jabba's tail, just horrible things like that. But anyway, so we get to this place where we had room to breathe, but there hasn't been any room. It's just like Star Wars movie, Star Wars movie, Star Wars movie, Star Wars movie. I think that is hurting the franchise.
I agree with you. And of course, Disney is the reason. They are taking over the planet, and they're out of control. They're out of control. Them and Amazon, both of them are going to combine forces somehow, and we'll just be sending our paychecks directly to them, like a direct deposit. To Disney, Amazon.
Yes. So but that's what I think. Everyone probably disagrees with me, and the money disagrees with me completely, right?
That's the thing. That's why they have us, because we're all going to see it, and we're all going to keep buying packages around Christmas from Amazon, because they're amazing. And so they have us. They just have us in their lair. But I agree with you. Having a Star Wars movie every year is starting to feel – it's starting to lose the magic.
It feels tired.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like I have like – you know, Star Wars fatigue.
Agreed. One good thing that I read recently was that because Disney bought 20th Century Fox, which scares me in one sense because they have so many more properties to expand. But one good thing is that for some reason they traded away A New Hope, the rights to the first Star Wars movie was traded away. Well, they've got it back now with the deal with 20th Century Fox, because they're the ones who snatched it up back in the day. And so now that Disney has total control over the entire original trilogy, they might release a version without George Lucas's edits. We might get a theatrical cut, which
I have a videotape.
Do you really?
Of
that's
Jedi
worth like thousands of dollars.
I don't think so. But I got a Jedi one where they changed everything at the end. They've got Hayden Christensen in the end of Jedi now. So it took terrible. The teddy bear picnic and they made it even worse.
Yeah.
You know, at the end. Uh-huh. And but I have the original one that doesn't have any of that junk in it.
Teddy bear picnic.
Yeah, that's what they call it.
The Ewoks.
Yeah, I like Ewoks. They're all right. I can deal with them. They're vicious enough to not quite be teddy bears.
Yeah, that's true.
They'll murder a stormtrooper with no reservations at all.
Uh-huh. But see, that subtlety's missing. You've got a new Ewok-like creature in the new Star Wars, but it's a cute little pog creature.
It's got to be murderous.
Yes.
That's
it's
got to
be cute
the whole,
and deadly.
Don't tell me about this. I want my Ewoks murderous.
No spoilers.
That's how I feel.
Good.
Straight, murderous Ewoks.
And that's Star Wars.
Don't try to give me the sweetened Ewoks.
We've covered it for you, folks. All right. As we said, we're here to talk about an Oscar movie, and that Oscar movie is, of course, The Shape of Water. Are you ready to dive in, Tim?
So when you say Oscar movie, I'm kind of interrupting here.
Oh, yeah.
What do you mean? You mean potential for Oscar?
Oh, yeah. It means that I've read up on the movies that have come down the pike and are coming down the pike, and this one is guaranteed to be nominated for multiple Oscars. It's just
the Green Award?
It's one of those in the pack. The what?
I don't know. I just made up the Green Award.
No, it'll probably be up for 5, 6. I mean, it was nominated for 7 Golden Globes, and it'll be up for probably that much, if not more, for the Oscars. It's just one of those movies that everyone's talking about.
It's a heavyweight.
It's a heavy hitter.
Bam.
Yes. So there you go. The Shape of Water. Let's talk about it. So how do we describe this movie? I guess the long story short of it is you've got this You got this cleaning woman who's mute, played by Sally Hawkins. And she is a cleaning woman. She's back. This is back in the 60s. It takes place in like the 60s. And she works at this government facility, this top secret facility, where they have discovered a creature, some sort of sea creature god type thing. And they're keeping it under wraps. And they are treating this creature with hostility. They're scared of it. And Sally Hawkins is this like mute cleaning woman who's just doing her job. And she has an encounter with this creature. And they end up forming a bond, an actual romance that becomes the heart of this movie. And then, of course, the government agents don't like that, and that becomes the central conflict. So that is a really shallow plot synopsis, but that gives you an idea of kind of what we're going for. Anything you want to add to that as far as just a story-wise?
Story-wise?
Yeah.
It's E.T.
It's E.T.
If E.T. was having sex with people.
Yeah. You just summed it all up in
there
a sentence.
Go.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's what I was looking
for.
That's
my thoughts on the plot.
Perfect. I'm sure you've got the visual in your mind, and we're all set. All right. So, look, it's a strange story, okay? There's no question. And that should really come as no surprise if you're at all familiar with this director, Guillermo del Toro, because this is his bread and butter. He is pretty much a genre director, and he is no stranger to these kind of stories. So, I mean, he's done Hellboy 2. Recently, he did Pacific Rim, which is kind of this big budget comic booky movie. And then, but really the movie that I think this is most similar to and that most people would recognize del Toro is Pan's Labyrinth.
Right.
That's the big one. And you recently rewatched this.
Mm-hmm.
Can you shed light on it's been way too long for me, and I should have rewatched it, but I didn't. What's Pan's Labyrinth like in 2017 as you rewatched it?
It's good. I mean, really, this guy's a fairy tale junkie.
Yes.
And so, can I reel in a little? Can
do
I go,
it.
Or like reel out?
Take
I
it
don't
away.
Know where I'm going. I've been thinking about this interview I heard with Maurice Sendak. You know who that is?
No.
He wrote Where the Wild Things Are. You know Where the Wild Things Are?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So, that book got criticized over and over and over again because it was too scary.
Mm.
And Sendak would say, actually, kids like scary things.
Mm-hmm.
Because like they're a little bit captivated by death. They're a little bit captivated by these things. And we're always trying to shield them. So we tend to have kids' movies, right? So I think when people hear a fairy tale, they assume kid movie or kid tale, right?
Yeah.
What I see with, I think he's fascinated with fairy tales, which are, there's some inherent danger. Because I heard this interview with Sendak, and he's like, no, there's got to be real danger here. It's got to have like real things happening. Mm-hmm. You can't just be safe.
Yeah.
So what I think of when I think of him, and I think of Pan's Labyrinth, and I think of the film we're reading today, is like, these are fairy tales, but they ain't kids, you know, kids movies.
They're adult fairy tales.
They're real, well, like the fairy tales used to be, right? Like
Grimm.
Like yep. A witch will eat you.
Yeah.
You know? So they're not safe.
Yes.
And I think there's something that we have sanitized our fairy tales and turned them into kids' films.
Mm-hmm.
Where everything works out and there isn't violence and there isn't. And I'm not advocating, well, it sounds like I am, but maybe I am. But what I'm saying is that I think kids are fascinated with authentic, real things.
Yeah.
And I think we are too. So he's fascinated by these fairy tales, but they are very unsafe type fairy tales where people can die and bad things happen and there's real evil in the world, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think the similarities that I see in the thematically, well, first off, they're beautiful. Both of them are beautiful movies to watch.
They really are. Visually, just stunning.
Yeah. And so I think, and they have good scores. But the thing that thematically which links them is they're both fairy tales,
mm-hmm.
and they both have evil male protagonists who are in power and abuse that power, and to the point of where they're probably sadistic, and there's torture,
mm-hmm.
sadistic, and mm-hmm. they're torturous,
mm-hmm.
and then the people who are that have compassion and gentility, which is funny because like gentlemen, right?
Yeah,
and have all these characteristics love, right? Those people tend to have no power.
Hmm.
And so it's kind of exploring some of that.
Both women protagonists in Pan's Labyrinth, it's a little girl.
Both,
right?
Yeah. Like, so in Pan's Labyrinth, it's a little girl who has very little power. Her mother has very little power, and she has to do what she can with what she has. And the same here where you have a mute woman in 1962 which that's, you know, obviously heavy symbolism. Like, she has no voice. Okay, yeah, because women, a lot of women in the Institute didn't have much voice.
Yeah.
Who has to try to fight a system in order to love something that's considered unlovable.
Hmm.
So it's kind of very similar in those. The Pan's Labyrinth is based in Franco's Spain. So okay. He's like a ruthless dictator actually during the war in Europe in 44. So, and then this one's based in the Cold War, the United States. So they're both very interesting.
I just remember in Pan's Labyrinth, that stunning image of that creature that holds his eyes in his hands. And it's just striking imagery.
It's creepy.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not safe. It's a fairy tale. It's unsafe.
Right. So you would also consider Shape of Water as sort of adult fairy tale. All right. Well, and I agree. It is. I'll just tell you I'm going to get my main criticism out of the way here up front. And that is that I found the tone and the kind of flow of the movie to be a little jarring, because I feel like the setup that Del Toro starts with is this really breezy, lightweight sort of tap dancey movie, basically as symbolism, you know, where characters are literally like they're watching this Eliza and her neighbor, played by Richard Jenkins, his name is Giles, they're watching, like, you know, movies, these old movies of people tap dancing, and they're literally tap dancing down the hall, and then she meets this creature, and there's kind of this whimsical creature feature 50s type thing, and then it's just punctuated by this really graphic sex and violence, right? And I know that that kind of fits into the adult fairy tale, but I felt like it was extremely jarring. And it's not like, look, one of our hallmarks of Cinema Faith is we don't get hung up on surface content. It's not like, oh, this has sex and violence, so it's bad. I'm just saying that it felt like it was really, like, you had contrasting tones going on, that it was like emotional whiplash. Did you get that sense at all, or was that just me?
No, I think I mean, it's like where you get like Hansel and Gretel, right? And then they push the witch into the oven.
Right.
So to me, I'm like, that's part of the fairy tale. Do I agree with that?
That's part of the world. Right.
Well, yeah. But I guess like the sex didn't bother me as much. I was just like, okay.
Yeah.
I guess if I can believe that this creature exists, I can believe that it can have sex. But I think the thing that that bothered me more was that something that would be a creature that would be compassionate would want to have revenge, which I think that's funny because I can't believe that in a story, but I could easily believe that in my own life. Right. It's like, right. I could be compassionate and I could also want revenge. Mm-hmm. But I think that's jarring to us.
And it's totally true to life. Like you just said, I mean, that's how life mm-hmm. works, but there's something about, I guess it's maybe I wish the movie had kind of had that lighter tone that you get in the first 20 minutes where and it just, yeah. But maybe that's just me projecting.
It's not just you. I forgot her name, the reviewer mm-hmm. who reviewed this for the Ebert website.
Okay.
That was her take too. Oh. And she said that the second half of this movie, the first half is like novel and like it's you're getting set up and you're like, oh, I've never seen anything like this in my life. Mm-hmm. This is amazing. This and the storyline is all it is novel. Like it's whimsical, it's the fairy tale, and then it kind of turns into just kind of strange.
Yeah.
And it doesn't resolve right, and it just has two different tones. It's kind of her
exactly
take.
Right.
And so I think that is a weakness of the film that would take it out of, say, like Best Picture contention.
Yeah,
is that you have to have, you need a film that has, that builds up and doesn't fall apart at the end, and this one kind of falls apart at the end.
Agreed. Okay, well, good, glad it wasn't just me. But I get what Del Toro's going for as well. And so I could see how someone could also make the argument that that is life, and that there's kind of this beauty that is in that, you know, we're all kind of grasping for flickers of warmth and beauty in the midst of a dark world. And I could get that argument too. And maybe it's also the fact that I couldn't quite get on board with the central relationship. Like, I think it was the execution of it. Just like, if you had this relationship that you're just sold on, that your heart is like soaring with, then maybe the darkness would not feel as just like this crashing element. I don't know. But yeah, there you go. Well, let's get more to the technical aspects of this, because I just, the things that really work about this movie, in spite of what we just said, are tons of things. First of all, the visual look and feel is incredible. Like, from the very first scene where you have the camera just gliding into this beautiful, like, set design of a floating room with her just kind of floating on her bed and the sofa floating. It's just, it's an incredible first scene that just kind of is already sells you on the magic of the movie. And I felt like the cinematography by Dan Lawson and Del Toro was incredible. What do you think about the look of things?
I like the look of it. I know color
yes.
plays into everything.
Yeah.
The thing that I like was the contrast between the apartment that our protagonist shares with her roommate. Well, there's two different apartments.
Yeah.
And the kind of that organic artsy. There's music. There's art. He's an artist.
Yeah.
And then the contrast of that versus the kind of normal guy, which would be the kind of evil villain of this film. But he lives like the ideal 1962 life. But they do it visually, where they take this dude who has 2.5 kids, and he has a wife that brings him dinner, and you know, she brings him dinner, and then like immediately she's like, "All right, it's time for sex."
He has like the typical home.
It's like ideal. He goes and he buys the teal Cadillac, and he hates green.
Yeah,
but it's really a green Cadillac. And so the idea is like he hates everything that is green. He hates, and his all the colors for his environment are totally different than the environment for everyone else, which is this like kind of earthy green color, right?
That's such a great observation. Yeah. He has kind of the idyllic like Pleasantville
Stepford
scenery. Like his house is set up with the perfect lighting and that kind of 50s TV in the living room.
But it points out that that's actually grotesque.
Mm-hmm.
So they use the lighting, they use the color, the difference in the color, and even in the facility that this guy works in, they all work in this facility. Mm-hmm. The lighting there is like this fluorescent lighting that, and everything kind of looks, it looks a little bit like steampunk, honestly.
Mm.
But everything is just heavy industrial. And then it has like these pastel kind of lights, like colors that kind of make it look very different.
Mm-hmm.
Versus the apartment and everything, anybody that's kind of, you know, a positive character gets green.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy hates his green Cadillac because it's not. Good. Yeah. But the idea being that I think the green is like life, right?
Yeah.
So those characters are like, a lot of times are deeply lonely and don't feel like they can connect and have deep relationship. Mm-hmm. And they're like seeking this like deep connection, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, and they're like all their characters. So this would be the Hawkins character. I can't remember anybody's name.
Sally Hawkins. It's all right. Yep.
And then the guy who's masterful performance, who's a next door neighbor, the gay next door neighbor.
Richard Jenkins.
Who's an artist. He's an artist.
Giles. Yep.
Giles. So Giles is like this like really beautiful character who's an artist who everyone would rather have a photograph than a painting or a drawing now.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, it's its own little microcosm, right? Of kind of this film, right?
Yes.
We'd rather have this than this. And so all this, the artsy people get the green.
And it's Michael Shannon plays the villain, who's this Richard. And he's the one who has the other setting that you're mentioning, the typical 50s that is really monstrous because he's a monster.
Right. And then like he's always doing these like setting up these dichotomies. So mm-hmm. you have, all he can think about is like, what's my next career level I'm going to achieve and how do I not mess that up?
Yeah.
And then what car would a successful person be driving? And he reads his Power of Positive Thinking
book.
That's
right.
And then he's willing to do anything it takes so that he is remembered and he can go down as like somebody, a man of greatness.
Yeah. He's on the hamster wheel of performance basically.
Yeah. That's a better way to put that. And so so I think he's interesting, but he's always pursuing like stuff mm-hmm. to like show his credentials and mm-hmm. this and that. And he's relentlessly doing that at the expense of people. And then the other characters that we see in this movie that are kind of the champions of like love, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're like super relational. They like, all they want is relationship.
Yeah.
Like each one of them, like, oh, if I only had like someone to love, mm-hmm. like, that's their thing. And they're always portrayed in green. So I just thought that was
I love it.
Kind of brilliant visual that you portray like this concept in color.
Mm-hmm. I have a friend who's like obsessed with law grace. He always looks for that in film. And that's kind of what you're describing, is this sort of this law grace dichotomy where Michael Shannon's character is just like, is obsessed with following the rules and getting ahead and performing right. And then you have the other characters, Richard Jenkins and Sally Hawkins, that are kind of just overflowing with grace and love. And yeah, it's a good contrast there. He would be delighted.
Like these ideas of decency come up, right?
Yeah.
So, there's a conversation between General Hoyt.
Yeah, and, that's a stunning scene.
Yeah, and he says like, I've done everything right for 17 years or something. Mm-hmm. Every single time I've done everything right, and I slipped up this one time, and can't you see it? You know, room to like just see that I'm a decent guy.
Yep.
And the response of Hoyt, who's like kind of the symbol of this industrial military Cold War dude, he says, oh no, that's not for this place. You know, I can't share what he actually said because it's a little graphic. But he's like, no, we don't have room for that here. We like to push that off onto other people. They tend to buy that about decency.
Yeah.
Sadie's like, why would you act decently here?
Your decency means nothing, basically.
Decency means perfection.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas decency would be compassion in another.
That's it.
So this is like perfection in performance.
Yep.
Where that would be decency for that complex, like this economic, whatever.
Yeah.
But for the other characters, no, it's compassion and love. It's relationship.
Beautiful. And so visually, it's stunning. And then the special effects add to that, of course, because the creature, who could always be dicey, when you've got a main character, you know, that's basically this otherworldly creature, it could get pretty sketchy with special effects, but it looked incredible. It looked perfect. Like, you could reach out and touch it. I don't know how they did it. There's probably a mix, as it should be, a mix of prosthetics with some CGI, but it was just perfect.
I don't know.
It doesn't.
I didn't read any technical stuff at all, to be honest with you.
It doesn't matter. The point is that it looked perfect, and unfortunately, that's not a given in 2017, Tim. That's the problem. I'm not going to say which character it is in Star Wars, but there's
Leia
a character.
Organa.
No. There is a character in the new Star Wars that they decided, in their infinite wisdom, to make completely CGI, and I don't get it, because it looks like it was made fresh off a computer, just printed off, and he sort of just doesn't walk quite right, and he doesn't sit down quite right, and it's like, people, is money a problem at Disney? Did they not give Rian Johnson a blank check? Are we having trouble with our technology in 2017 that we're still saying, yep, checking off the final product on this CGI character that doesn't look right? I don't get it.
Well, but this guy, all right, so Guillermo del Toro is a master, right?
Yes.
I mean, if you think about it, like, Peter Jackson's about to hand The Hobbit over to him, and he was unable to do it.
Yes. I would have loved to see his version.
But I know. but that tells you something right there, right? Yeah. So he's like, oh, yeah, take The Hobbit. Go for it. That shows you, like, his level of mastering, like, creatures. Mm-hmm. So this guy is, like, he's an expert.
He is.
And so I think it's a good commentary on his stuff that I didn't think about it.
Because the best special effect is you don't think about
it. I didn't think about him. Right. I was just like, of course he's this skilled creature. And he looked right. He sounded right. Everything about him was like, yeah, that could maybe exist, right? Yep. We just haven't found this cryptid yet. But like, it was perfect.
Exactly.
So he got it right. If it's a main character, you got to do it right.
It's like, are we having any debate over whether Emperor Palpatine from the original Star Wars trilogy looks real?
No,
of course not. No, because in the 70s, they were smart enough to realize that you put some prosthetics on and it's not even a thing you think about. Just makes my head explode. I don't get it.
I love it. I feel like we've reversed roles here as far as like hating of CGI.
I hate it.
It's fine.
I love CGI if I don't notice it, but when it stands out like that, you know, and Rogue One was the worst example with Leia and Moff Tarkin bringing them back, and it just looked terrible. And we talked about that in our Blade Runner podcast, that the director of the new Blade Runner, Denis Villeneuve, was like, he basically saw that and was like, yeah, I can't have
Don't get me started on the Polar Express.
I love the Polar Express.
No, you're wrong.
Whatever. But remember, I'm the one who's admitted that Muppet's Christmas Carol is like my number two.
Something happens to you at Christmas, you start losing your mind. It's a good thing that we have all these Academy Award quality pictures to keep your minds off of these other films.
It's pretty sad.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the score. I love the score. Works perfectly with the visuals, and it just adds to the magic. Alexander Desplat. I'm totally probably ruining that name. I'm so sorry, Alexander.
He's probably not listening.
I know. Well,
he could be, and he could be taking offense right now, and your site is gone.
His IMDb page is just insane. He's scored some incredible movies. He's worked with Wes Anderson. He's worked on a ton of Oscar movies like The King's Speech. This is a really seasoned composer, and I thought it was a beautiful score to listen to. It was one that I would actually pop in and actually listen to it, like on my phone.
What is keeping Wes Anderson in business, man?
Did you see that trailer for his Isle of Dogs?
Yeah.
Oh, it's strange. I don't know whether. Yeah, I mean, it looks interesting. It looks like I would want to see it, but like,
what's part the last of film he did? He's obsessed with islands. Like,
yeah,
everything is an island. Even Zuzu is like on an island at some point.
That's right, Life Aquatic. Yeah. What was the last one he did? It was about an island. Moonrise Kingdom.
Moonrise Kingdom. Yeah. And I came going like, oh, that was kind of neat. What?
Dude, Rushmore is still his best movie, and that's like his second.
We have one of our authors is obsessed with. Is it Cooper? Yeah,
I think so. I think it's Brian. It's Mr. Brian Cooper.
So if you love Wes Anderson, go read Brian Cooper,
and
he will feed the fire of Wes Anderson. Don't listen to us about this because we. I don't know how you feel. You're probably all right with him.
I'm all right with him. I mean, I thought that his early stuff was way better than his last few movies, which I think he's kind of jumped the shark a bit. He just can't do anything different. Like, it's just the same. Tropes.
Was his first
again and again?
Was Bottle Rocket his first movie?
Bottle Rocket was his first one. Rushmore was his second. I believe Rushmore is his best movie.
That's a good movie
with Bill Murray.
No, Royal Tenenbaums.
Royal Tenenbaums was third, and that really is a good movie. And then once Life Aquatic hit, it just started to all become a little kitsch.
I even like Life Aquatic. It just seems like once you give this guy like budget for animation, he just loses it.
Yeah, Isle of Dogs. I don't know. All right, and then of course acting. We can't forget about these performances. So Sally Hawkins is the main character here. Her name's Eliza, and she is bound to be nominated for an Oscar. It's a deadlock. She was already nominated for a Golden Globe. I thought she was wonderful. You're shaking your head. You don't think this performance is worthy of an Oscar, Tim Nelson?
Trying to think, I'm missing one of these things. Has there been somebody that's been nominated for an Oscar that doesn't speak in the film in the role?
I don't know. It's a great question.
I feel like there might be.
Helen Keller? Who played the miracle worker back in the day? I'm just ranting this off the top of my head.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that. But I'm trying to think maybe there is somebody. I want to say, actually, yes, it's Daniel Day-Lewis. In My Left Foot.
He doesn't speak.
Does he speak in that movie?
I honestly don't think I've ever seen it.
All right. Viewers, write into us. Email us. Post on our whatever. What do we have for them to post on?
It's podcast@cinemafaith.com. Rant. Yeah,
rant. Be like, guys, get your... Totally. There's like five different actors that haven't spoken, been nominated.
I would say
Daniel Day-Lewis is what... I don't remember that film because it's been like 10 years since I watched it.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to think that My Left Foot, he doesn't speak.
Okay.
But I could be wrong.
Or for
half of it, he doesn't speak something like that.
Yeah.
So that could be totally wrong. Sorry, guys. It's just been a long time. And we watch a lot of movies.
We do.
But yeah.
But Sally Hawkins, she's great. I mean, she communicates everything in her character without speaking, in her looks and her and just like she exudes this sort of like joyful optimism that kind of just comes out of her. I thought it was great. I liked her.
You know what she was compared to by one of the reviewers was silent era movie.
Yes.
Actresses. So exaggerated. Mm-hmm. So she did everything with some level of exaggeration, and she had to really work her eyes, and all of her gestures are bigger than a person would normally do them.
Yep.
So it was like Chaplin-esque.
And that's Oscar-worthy to me. And like you said, Richard Jenkins, who's been a great character actor for forever, plays Eliza's neighbor, Giles. And his best film was The Visitor. That's where he played the lead. He played this guy who sees someone doing like the drums on the street, and he ends up taking that up. You ever seen that movie? It's called
No?
The Visitor.
Oh.
It's really good. He was nominated for Best Actor for that back in the day. But that was the best movie I've seen him in. But anyway, he's really good here, and he's like just at his best when he's taking on these sort of character roles that you can't put your finger on why you want to keep watching him, but he always brings something unique to his roles, and he was great in this. Yeah. And
I thought his performance was beautiful. Mm-hmm. I see him definitely being nominated for a supporting role.
Yep, and he was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actor, and he very well could be for Best Actor or for Best Supporting in Oscars for sure. Michael Shannon, I am a huge fan of his. I think, like, you know, back in, you know, I'm a huge fan of that movie that he was in, Take Shelter. We watched that together, where the storm is coming, and I think he's a great actor. I just didn't like his character. I thought his character was a bit over the top, and I think that's more just on the fault of the writing than Michael Shannon's performance, but I just thought it wouldn't, yeah.
I mean, he's like, he has no nuance. He's like a sadistic, torturous Nazi type.
Right.
He's not Nazi, but that's his, he's a one-dimensional character.
Brief spoiler alert, just 2 seconds. Like, there's a point where he's literally quoting Solomon and his fingers are falling off. I mean, there's just a point where you're just like, really? Like, come on, man.
No.
Yeah. Quoting Solomon. I mean, reciting the story of not Solomon. Dang it.
Samson.
Samson. Yes. He's literally reciting the story of Samson, and he's got gangrene fingers that he's pulling off his hand, and you're just at a point, no nuance, I think is the best way to describe that. Yeah.
Yeah. If we learn anything, we want our evil characters to have little flecks of good in them, right?
Yeah. That makes the best evil characters, is where you can actually, you have some sort of rationale for why they're doing what they're doing, and it makes sense a little bit.
Right.
Side note on Michael Shannon, by the way, I don't know if you're a fan of Groundhog Day. We did a podcast on it. Of course you are.
I am a fan of Groundhog Day. Refer to podcast Shannon, from 2 years ago.
Yes. On Groundhog Day. It came out on Groundhog Day, and we'll release it every Groundhog Day for your listening pleasure.
That's a great idea.
Yes. But Michael Shannon's in that movie. Did you know that? He plays the WrestleMania couple at the very end when Bill Murray gives them WrestleMania tickets, and he's like, oh, WrestleMania, no way! And he hugs his girlfriend. That's Michael Shannon at like 17 or something.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Just a little punk kid. Just getting his first big shot role. There you go.
That was a big shot role.
I mean, not
role,
a big
huh?
shot role, but his first on-screen sort of, you know, deal.
Recognized. Yeah. I'm sure he was credited even.
Yes, credited.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, so there you go. I do have one bone to pick, though, okay? So look, Golden Globes are January 7th, and Golden Globes are always like they're the precursor to the Oscars. You have it's basically like Golden Globes and the Oscars are the two big award shows. Golden Globes are the weird one. That's where they get really drunk. That's the Hollywood Foreign Press, yeah. Alcohol's flowing freely, and it's not only movies, but it's also movies and TV, and then they do these really weird, all the tables are set up around each other, so there's, my favorite part of the Golden Globes is watching all the actors interact with each other right before they go to commercial. So they'll like cut to a commercial, and then all of a sudden you'll see like Leonardo DiCaprio talking to, you know, Harrison Ford, and you're just like, what are they talking about right now? Anyway, Golden Globes are the weird one, but anyway, this movie, Shape of Water, has been nominated for 7 Golden Globes. Okay, we've already talked about most of them. You got Best Picture, Best Director, Actress, Supporting Actor, Score, Screenplay. But then, this one gets me. Best Supporting Actress for Zelda, who was played by Octavia Spencer. That's the Eliza's assistant. What is that? Like, there was nothing about their performance that was, like, awards anything. Do you see where they're coming from on that at all?
No.
Crazy.
So I thought she was, I thought she's okay.
She's fine.
But she's playing a character that needs to be there so that she can fight with the antagonist.
But the character has no arc.
You're right.
Yeah.
Like there's not a lot there.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's a little arc, but I guess the main reason is she can be the voice of our protagonist.
But there is a little arc with her husband towards the end. You're right.
I guess. They got to do something.
Yeah. The reason why it makes me frustrated is that the same exact thing happened last year for Hidden Figures. You remember that movie about the NASA women, which was great? But, like, she was nominated, and the lead, Taraji Henson, who was, like, the lead of the movie, she didn't get nominated at all. They nominated Octavia Spencer. And, like, I'm just like, did you, like, switch envelopes? Because, like, that's the award performance right there. She's like going toe to toe with Kevin Costner and she gets nothing, and you award Octavia Spencer. I don't know.
I just didn't think, I thought her, it wasn't that she did anything wrong.
Right. No. It's not bad by any stretch.
I think that just the character, if you're looking for a role, that character is not, it's not going to be an award winning role.
Exactly. I hope that the Oscars did not follow suit with that, because that's crazy. All right. So we're running out of time, so let's get into the real meat here. I want to talk about theme, specifically in relation to faith. What do you think, Tim? What do you got?
So this, what do I have? I can tell you like a little bit about the director and kind of his views.
Do it.
And then we could talk. Hopefully that'll launch some kind of conversation. I think with art, this is like kind of my theology, philosophy of art. I would hope that we don't try to get art, like movies, to align completely with our perspective.
Of course.
Because that would just reinforce us, right? But I'd hope that they would create better thinking and better conversation, better dialogue. And there are some times when movies are so bad or they're pornographic or any of that, where you wouldn't want to be part of that.
Yep.
You wouldn't want to watch them. But anyway, with this film, I go back to the author. You can tell like that whoever wrote this film, whoever directed this film, like Del Toro, has been steeped in a religious tradition, which is true. He's a Catholic guy. He was.
Okay.
He would describe himself as an atheist. But he would call storytelling his spirituality. I don't think what he means is he doesn't believe in any metaphysics. I don't think he believes that, but I think he is very highly suspect of institutions, which probably because he's familiar with them.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And so you think about Catholicism or the church in general. And I know that
religion,
right? Yeah. So, you know, I'm a theist. And I believe Jesus is the Son of God. I'm a Trinitarian theist, right?
You're Orthodox.
I'm Orthodox, right?
Good.
So within the Christian tradition.
Yeah.
So when I look at him, I'd say, you know, he's not Orthodox within the Christian tradition, but I think he's probably experienced some kind of levels of institutional disenfranchisement or where he's been burned.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's true or not, but I sense that. I know he's in some ways he's almost like anarchist in his own beliefs.
Hmm. Politically, you mean?
Yeah, like most of his films are attacking any kind of like large systems of enforcement of things. So he's anti-authoritarian.
Sure.
So in this film, he's as critical as of the Russians as he is of the United States.
Right, right.
It's like, oh, yeah, these are just different white guys who are trying to be authoritarians. And this authoritarianism takes people who know less about all kinds of things and puts them in positions of power to harm others. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like what you see. You see this in Pan's Labyrinth, too.
Okay.
And so the idea is, like for me, with him, I think about the church, right?
Yes.
So the church is in this position of being able to hurt others. And if it's doing so, like, you know, for him, he can't get on board with that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he could possibly, you know, he might be, especially based on Pan's Labyrinth, he might be a fan of the person of Jesus or the story of Jesus, even if he doesn't believe in the historicity of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say the institutional church would probably turn him off completely, which I'm hoping that we have some listeners that feel that same way. Maybe if the institutional church has like hurt you or has been something that you go, oh, I like this Jesus guy, but this church stuff, oh man, it seems like there's pain everywhere.
I think many of us can relate to that.
Yeah. I would say.
Because it's like the ultimate, church is in the ultimate position to hurt you because they encourage you to bleed, basically, you know, and then the sharks come and eat you alive, you know, if you're in the wrong circles. And yeah.
So I would say, right, or vulnerability would be denied. Like people, so you could be vulnerable. Like you think you'd be vulnerable in a place where people would be safe.
Yep.
And maybe that's not the case.
No.
So what I would say is he's anti-authoritarian. And I would say within our culture, we have tried to set the church up as an authoritarian kind of regime.
Mm.
And so this film has different theologies that I see in it. One of is this theology of the outsider. So in the Gospel of Luke, I've talked about this thing before on the podcast. Theologians say that Luke has a preferential option for the poor. And maybe we've talked about this. And the idea is that you see over and over again within this gospel that that God is on the side of the outsider. God is on the side of the person who doesn't quite fit in. God is on the side of the literal poor person, the person who has no property, who has no power, who is not in control. And in this film, we see that the champions are those people, and they're not the, you know, the dominant narrative, which is the white kind of Nietzschean Ubermensch that, hey, if I just keep on not failing, then I have total, then I'll be successful.
Yeah, totally. And think about how that Michael Shannon's character creates, like, his norm, his orientation of what is right and what is good is totally based in on himself, right? And he drags God into the mess. There's that one powerful scene where he's talking to Eliza and Zelda, and he's basically like, you know, obviously this creature is not made in God's image. We're made in God's image. And you think God looks like that? No, he looks like us. And then he says to Zelda, who's black, well, he doesn't look like you, more like me than you.
Probably a little more like me than you.
Yeah.
So, right. So obviously he brings this idea of like who is made in God's image.
Mm-hmm.
And so even like Luke's, I think we see in scripture in Genesis, we say, well, we're all made in God's image.
Yes.
And then they ask the question, well, what about this creature we didn't know about? It sounds like he's sentient and he's got feelings and he's like, you know, all these things. Mm-hmm. You go, I don't know. And it asks a question like, maybe the people that we have thought of as subhuman in some kind of way, well, maybe they're human and maybe they're actually more human. Mm. So in this, you see the humanity of the people who were considered lower.
Yeah.
Actually, you see that they are more human and less twisted and bizarre, and they value other humans more.
Well, that's right. Yeah. When Jesus sums up the whole law in love your neighbor as yourself, and then what's our first question? Well, who's my neighbor? And what's Jesus' response? Oh, the parable of the Good Samaritan, right? Who was complete, that whole group of people was completely reviled by the Jews. That's who he was talking to.
Yeah. So I like the, yeah, so that you take marginalized folks. Now, there have been some criticisms in the film that basically the black experience has been used like a chip, but not actually appreciated.
That's interesting.
So just get like they throw in fire hose scenes from Birmingham.
Like they do that in the apartment, and Richard Jenkins is like, turn it off. I don't want to watch that. Right? It's like it feels very added in to kind of have this. You understand what they're going for, where the creature is kind of like the people that are the black people in the '60s and what they was going through. But it does feel kind of tossed in. It's not given very proper treatment, and I could see how they would feel used by. Yeah.
Right. So there was some critique there, but I don't. I think the whole idea of the outsider or the person that was considered subhuman actually maybe being, you know, they call actually in this film, the people in power call the swamp creature or whatever you want to call them, the asset.
Yes.
So, and you see in that, because this is totally Del Toro's kind of bent. He's like anti-capitalist and all this, that they would call a person or like a being an asset. Oh, do we know what the situation with the asset is? Let's do a full, we're going to dissect him and that'll be better. And so they're all trying to find like how can we get the most possible benefit here?
Yeah.
For our particular side.
And isn't that what always happens when you've declared someone as less than human, you know, 3/5 human in the case of black
people?
Right,
you commodify people.
Yeah.
So the idea is like he's been commodified to, okay, well, we can keep him alive here in this tank and we'll feed him some, you know, gas or whatever he eats until he becomes not useful to us anymore.
Yep.
Or if he becomes useful to our enemies, we'll kill him.
Yeah.
And I think like that's the same view that we tend to take. We've talked about this a little bit, is that, well, if we take that view as Christians, it's a slippery slope, right? Then you get into like Nazi thinking, basically, exactly. Like eugenics and bizarre thinking that leads into like creating kind of caste systems and classes of humanity. I think we talked this when we talked Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how about this? You mentioned that it felt jarring for the creature to exert revenge. But one thing I was thinking of is that it's amazing how the people that we fear because they're different than us, and then which in turn makes us treat them as less than human. That actually creates a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? So when we treat someone, when we're scared of a group of people, and then we treat them hostily. They could actually become the very thing that we fear, right? So the creature's essence in this movie isn't violent. It's actually very – what we see his essence with Sally Hawkins' character is that it's actually very curious. He has healing properties, etc. But Michael Shannon, in his dehumanizing of him because he's scared of what he might do, actually creates the very thing that he's scared of in the creature. Which it just brings up like a modern day example maybe would be the Muslim ban. It's like we're scared of terrorism, so we've got to ban all the Muslims. That might actually radicalize more Muslims and create the very thing that we fear.
Right. Yeah. So this is really critical to Orthodox Christianity, well, and Judaism too, right? So like the major three I'll hold this in. So the image of God, the very image of God, right, is on all people. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, no matter, even if you, you know, as if you're really conservative and you hate certain groups and all this other stuff, it's just like, this is like clear. If you're going to read the book, it's like in the first book of the book.
Yeah.
You're going to see this is just refuted. Like, this is just flat wrong.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting. I know there's a couple, you get these narratives that come out and you get the Samson narrative, right?
Yes. When we were talking earlier, you said, what are the stories that these characters are telling themselves? And one of them, from Michael Shannon's perspective, like you said, is the Samson narrative. That means a lot to him. And what does that say about his character, right?
Well, it's interesting because what happens with Samson is he crosses the boundary of the Philistines, right?
Yeah.
And he gets tricked by a Philistine.
Uh-huh.
And that takes his power away. So the idea is to go to the other, is to have your power, is to have your hair cut and have your power taken away.
Oof, yeah.
And so that's like his narrative is, if I do anything that doesn't just kind of like stay with my own folks and if I'm vulnerable in any way,
yeah,
my power will be taken away, which is affirmed by the general, right? That is true.
Yeah.
And see what happened here.
Yeah.
So he's always about silencing people. He prefers a sexual partner that is completely silent. That's pretty weird, right? So yes. He like wants this intimacy, but he doesn't want to have the voice of anyone else there, just his voice.
Nice.
Very creepy.
Yes.
So anyway, so that's one of those narratives, and the Samson narrative, like, you know, is, well, you know what happened to Samson? They took his power, but his hair, you know, the Lord gave him strength and his hair grew back and he took down all his enemies at the end.
He's going to go down swinging, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so like he latches onto this biblical narrative.
Yeah.
And then I see another narrative, which was interesting, that kind of, they were showing like one of these movies that, you know, it's like a movie from the early 60s, like, you know, the Ben-Hur kind of category, except not as good.
You're talking about the movie theater that's below where
below
they live.
Below where they live. I'm sorry. I never give enough preface for this stuff. So our protagonist and then her friend live in this movie theater above the movie theater. And there's this movie playing, which is like the Book of Ruth or something.
Mm.
And they show this establishing shot 3, 4, maybe, I don't know how many times, a bunch. I only saw the movie once and I remember this clearly over and over again. Save the Book of Ruth and Mardi Gras. Those are the two movies. So the Book of Ruth is like an interesting one where Ruth decides to link her, is a young woman, right? And she marries into this family of people that are not her people. And her husband dies. And she makes the choice to stay because of love, stay with her mother-in-law. You know, and she says, you know, wherever you're going to go, I'm going to go with you and your people will be my people, right?
So you're saying it's like Eliza and Giles are kind of like the Ruth and Naomi sort of.
The idea is that the other is this opportunity to show like to cling, right? So I'm going to cling to you. I'm going to follow you. If things go bad for you, I'm going to be with you. Things go great for you, whatever happens, I'm going to be with you. Even though there doesn't look like there's a future or a hope or anything.
Yeah.
I'm going to be with you. And so we see that in the Book of Ruth. And so Ruth and Naomi, and those two characters remind me quite a bit of Giles and why do I forget her name over your time?
And Eliza.
And Eliza.
Yeah. And Naomi and Ruth, it's Ruth. I think it's Ruth is the one that sends her off, right? Sends Naomi off to be betrothed to the guy.
Boaz?
Yeah, Boaz.
Yeah.
I think. But anyway, yeah, so in the same way, you've got this sort of Giles assisting Eliza in this creature romance.
Right. It's
really interesting.
It doesn't have to directly correlate.
No,
but I think it's
beautiful. I think it does correlate.
Yeah.
Why else would he pick Ruth?
I mean,
that's very specific.
So those are two images of somebody who's the, you know,
I love it,
clinging to the outsider or rejecting the outsider and seeing them as a threat or seeing them as somebody that you have that you can deep that you will deeply connect with no matter what.
Just think about the level of detail that we just discussed there. This is all Del Toro. Just the fact that, you know, you don't just put the great directors. This, you know, we talk about this in film school all the time. Mise en scène. Great directors don't just put on some random movie on the in the theater downstairs. No, you put on a movie that means something, that actually correlates with the thematic elements that are on there, right? And you mm-hmm. and the way that you mentioned the setup of Michael Shannon's house versus their house, and just every detail means something. And this movie is chock full of detail in every scene. It's really beautiful. Mm-hmm. I think definitely Del Toro deserves a Best Director nomination. Even though the movie's questionable on Best Picture. Yeah.
He's drawing imagery from everywhere he can. I mean, the whole thing's Frankenstein, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's got all these myths that he can draw from and he can allude to, and then they form kind of like, they draw on all of our previous understandings of these things. Mm-hmm. What's kind of fun is that we are becoming biblically illiterate as a culture.
Yes.
And so now sometimes these movies, which we'll know really well, will be like, well, who the heck is Ruth? What's the Book of Ruth? And then we can go back and read them. If that's you,
it's
awesome.
Beautiful.
That's
yeah.
awesome. And, you know, it draws us deeper into our narrative because, we, you know, that's cool. I mean, if you're a Christian, it draws you into our narrative more and go, oh, why would he do this? See, because the art's kind of going, you know, toe-to-toe with our narrative, which is cool.
I mean, that's what we're passionate about at Cinema mm-hmm. Faith, right? Jesus yeah. taught in parables. What would he teach about today? Would he draw modern film examples? I think so. I think it's great. All right, final thoughts. Tim, this is your chance. What are your thoughts of Shape of Water in a nutshell with your letter grade?
So I give Shape of Water a B+. Okay. Visually, we've talked about that, so that's an A right on the visual. I think the second half breakdown, that's where I think we really are struggling. It's like where if you look at Pan's Labyrinth, the second half, like all the threads come together.
Mm-hmm.
But with this film, I don't feel like that occurs, and so the acting is good. Yep. So it's like I'd give it an A for acting, an A for the visuals, the cinematography, all that. And then we get to the story, and the story is what suffers
yep.
because it lacks resolve. And then the other thing is I think there's some it does have some story issues, and the characters are not – I think the bad characters are a little bit too evil and the good characters are a little too good.
I think that's
so
right on,
yeah. So they are fairy tale characters. And because of that, because we struggle with having a fairy tale character, I think that that's a problem for the film. So I would say it's a B+. I'm sure it'll win some awards, but I'm not willing to go into the A category with it.
Boom. I agree with everything you just said. We are in total agreement. B+. Yes, that's my grade as well. Tim said it. He said it. One thing I will just add is that the movie does grow on you. I will say that. It is unlike anything you've seen this year, and I think you walk away with that feeling that I've witnessed something that is special, that is memorable, that is magical even. And I did like it the more that I thought about it. And so it's a grower. But I do agree that right now I am landing on a B+. Maybe multiple watches will have.
Well, I was going to ask you that. Would you watch it again?
I would. I would watch it again.
I might watch it one more time.
One more time. Yeah.
I don't know if I would watch it over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm finding about that I will. Here's what's happening to me. I texted you the other day this. You know, you have a list. I need to start a list too. I don't have one.
Uh-huh.
Guardians of the Galaxy gets better. Every time I watch it, it's on Netflix, right? Well, it's the second one.
Flipping out about this movie.
Movie is better and better every time you watch it. And this is what I would call it. I know this is not where we're supposed to be going right now. The most watchable movie of the year. Like if you're going to like hang out with some friends and or like even like, you know, I don't know how old your kids are, but some stuff's inappropriate in that movie, some's not.
Mm-hmm.
But like if you're going to hang out with a group of people and you want to watch a film that at the end of it, you're like, that was super entertaining. That was intellectual.
You watch Lady Bird.
No, you don't watch Lady Bird.
Yes,
if you
want to,
if you're a millennial, you watch Lady Bird. You go watch it by yourself on your laptop.
Oh, my.
What?
By the way, I listen. Side note: I saw a tweet that said, I'm going to butcher it, but it said, I want to watch Christopher Nolan watching Dunkirk on their phone in 70mm.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's like how can I isolate and have an individual experience on a small screen possible?
Sorry. Go ahead. No.
But yeah.
Guardians of the Galaxy 2. You're a big fan.
Well, it's also right now, it's on Netflix. So if you're like hanging out, it's the holidays, and you want to watch a good movie. And that movie, the more and more I watch that movie, the more it says about family. And I look at that movie as being like pretty significant.
Nice.
As far as it has, I know I was critical of it.
Well, I will rewatch that. No, you liked it a lot more than I did.
I did. I thought it was heavy-handed in its themes.
I did too.
I know we're not supposed to be talking about this film.
It's okay.
But I thought it was heavy-handed in the themes. But this thing's aging well, man. It's like it's
like
a fine wine.
Yeah. Like ice wine.
It's like ice wine or whatever. I don't know. Whatever. But the it is. It's aging well, man. It's mellowing out. It's good.
All right. There you have it. Tim, believe it or not, this is our final podcast of 2017. It has been a great year talking film with you. I am just so grateful that every single month of this year you were willing to sit down and have a talk with me. It's the highlight of my month every time. So thank you for being a part of this. And thank you, dear listeners, because we wouldn't do this without you. You tune into us every month, and your support means the world to us. So thank you for being on this journey.
Hey, if you guys write in, we'll send you a t-shirt. It's not a Cinema Faith t-shirt. It'll just be a t-shirt I have.
It's true. Tim will send you
I will. As long as you're not international, I don't want to pay the postage on it. I'll just send you one of my old t-shirts. Okay?
Did you hear that? All you got to do is write in. What's the email address? podcast@cinemafaith.com. Send us your feedback. Let us know what's up.
I've got a great old Alabama t-shirt or a Weezer t-shirt maybe. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'll pick up. It'll probably have a hole in it. Yeah. But it's yours if you write in and give us your info so we can send it to you. But you have to say something about the podcast.
You have to say something about the podcast, and maybe it would be helpful if you could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. That would help us so much. It expands our show on iTunes. The best way to support us, just a little rate and review on Apple Podcasts and an email to podcast@cinemafaith.com and a t-shirt is coming your way. Those are the parameters right there.
Just a t-shirt. I can't guarantee the quality nor size of it. It awesome. Will have been worn by me.
All right, Tim. Are you ready to say goodbye to this year?
I am.
Happy New Year. The time has come. And the question we always ask at the end of every year is, what new stories are coming our way in 2018? What will we be talking about a year from now? It's always super exciting.
What will we be talking about in February and March, mostly, when there's nothing to talk about.
You're right. It's so weird because the actual movie season is like end of February to end of February, right? Because the season isn't really over until the Oscars. The Oscars are the final. It's like the end of the year for. So it's kind of weird. But and then January and February is like this gulf. But there's still a couple of good movies coming out. We've got I, Tanya, which always looks kind of interesting, right?
It's just voyeuristic, man. I'm like, what did she do?
And then Phantom Thread, which is Paul Thomas Anderson's movies coming out in January.
And speaking of Daniel Day-Lewis, as we did earlier, possibly his final film?
Yeah, that's what he said. He said this is his final performance, so how about that? We'll see. All right. Keep the faith, my friends. We will see you in 2018.